So when I first started having conversations with families from, you know, different walks of life, that's when I came to understand that there is a common bond that we all share, that we're all really seeking the same things. And knowing that that thing was happiness came from the show. And every day I would sit and talk with the audience for a half hour, sometimes 40 minutes. A producer would be like, oh my God, when is she gonna let go of the audience? What I really want is to have a conversation with the audience to see, why did you come and what did you get from the show and did you benefit at all and why do you watch, all of that. So 10 years in, the audience became my focus group. I would always ask people, what do you want? What would it take to make you happy? And most people, when I say, what do you want? They just say, I just want to be happy. Tell me what that looks like. And as the years progressed, women were more able to identify what that specifically was. But when I first started asking that question in the mid-90s, they would always just say, well, I just want to be happy. I just want to be happy. Well, what does that look like?
Define it. Define happiness.
Define it. And what I realize is that most people have never defined it. And then they'd say, well, I want my kids to be happy. Well, that's your kids, but what do you want? And so being able to answer specifically what that looks like for you is the beginning of being happier. I know this, that many of the things that have happened to you have also happened for you. And that I learned when the crisis or the challenge showed up for me, I immediately would ask, sometimes out loud, but certainly in my own conscious spirit, what is this here to teach me? And how can I get that lesson as soon as possible? And this I guarantee you, the moment you have the conscious realization of, oh, this is why this is here, showing up to allow me to see whatever that is in your life, it changes for you.
Unhappiness is not the enemy.
No, it is not the enemy. The unhappiness, and if actually one of the things that's so powerful, I think, about what Arthur has written specifically is about how your emotions are there to allow you to feel the feel and then take the wheel of this feeling that I'm having this feeling, and now I need to do what? And not to allow yourself to be overcome by the feeling. So you have a feeling of anger, you have a feeling of sadness, you have a feeling of disappointment. Doesn't mean you are those things, you are those emotions. So now what am I going to do now that I'm feeling disappointed about a certain thing? You say, happiness is not a destination, happiness is a direction. I know that was a shift in mindset for many who are reading this book. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, and you know, this is, the problem with happiness is such a funny thing because we all want it. Every philosopher and theologian has talked about it. Everybody, I mean, how many times have people said that on your show?
I know, that's what I say in the beginning of the book, that
thousands of times.
I became interested in the subject because every time I would sit with the audience and I'd say, what do you want? Everybody would always say, multiple people would answer, I just want to be happy. I just want to be happy. Yeah. But yet when you ask them, what does that look like for them? Hard to define.
For sure. And part of the reason is because it's not something that you can define in any meaningful way. We think it's a feeling. We think it's a destination. Mm-hmm. It isn't either. Happy feelings are nothing more than emotions, and emotions are nothing more than information that we need in reaction to the outside environment. And as a destination, why would you want to be completely happy as the destination? You'd be dead in a week because you actually need negative emotions and experiences to train you, to keep you vigilant, to keep you safe, and to be happy.
Yeah, to keep you alert, to keep you on it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe when I die and I'm in heaven and I see the face of God, the beatific vision will be pure happiness. But on earth, I'm telling you, I need my negative emotions to keep me alive and safe. I need my negative experiences to learn and grow. And so that's what people, they want to stay alive and safe, but they don't want the feelings that keep them alive and safe. And that's this conflict that they have, which is why they feel so unsettled.
Okay, so I think, particularly in this world of social media, people think if I just get that,
I mean, I see people toasting on private jets, and I see them, you know, on beaches and, you know, their hair blowing in the wind and all that. And people think, well, if I just had that, I could be happy. But we know, you have the science to back it up, that there are really four pillars. And if you don't have all of those pillars working in your life, you will eventually end up feeling not necessarily sad, but lonely or distanced or disconnected.
That's right.
So the four pillars are.
Yeah, the four pillars. There's kind of the four pillars you think that you need and those four pillars that you really do need. The idols, the things that look right but aren't, are money, power, pleasure, and fame. Those are the things that Mother Nature says. You get those, you're going to be happy.
Money, power, pleasure, and fame.
That's right, but she lies. Mother Nature lies. She lies a lot because she wants us to keep running, right?
Yeah. Because, but is Mother Nature telling us that or is society telling us that?
Well,
I think Mother Nature is telling us that it's the four pillars.
Well, Mother Nature gives us these imperatives because she wants us to be hungry. You know, and she wants us to survive and pass on our genes.
Yes.
And the way that you do that is with money, power, pleasure, and fame, right? And she doesn't want us to figure out that those things never really satisfy so that we'll keep running and running and running. That's called the hedonic treadmill.
You're right.
What we really want, and this is backed up by a lot of psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics, all the research that we want, mm-hmm. is that there's kind of four things that are the virtuous things that we should be looking for. That Mother Nature doesn't necessarily tell us, but that if we take the divine path in life, mm-hmm. religious or not religiously understood, a better path in life, mm-hmm. we'll be happy. And those are faith, family, friends, and work that serves. Now, if you give any teenage kid the choice between money, power, pleasure, and honor, or
Faith,
family,
friends,
you know, good friends and good times and a work that serves others. I mean,
they're
what are you going to take?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, our society does aid and abet Mother Nature's lie.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the marketing colossus tells us that if you get that car, man, you're going to be really happy. If you get that job, you get that money. If you get that 100,000 Instagram followers or whatever your number happens to be, it's never high enough, by the way. You're going to be happy. But that's a lie is the bottom line. There's nothing wrong with those things.
Yeah.
But if you get those things, if we are so lucky to get those things, they should only ever be in service of the big four, the good four. They should only ever be in service. They should be intermediate goals. A rest stop on the New Jersey mm-hmm. Turnpike, Manhattan, where you're trying mm-hmm. to get, is faith. And by that,
How do you use that money, power, pleasure, and fame to enhance your faith, family, and work?
And friendship.
And friendships. How
basically, your love.
Yes, your
love.
The love
in your life.
Yeah.
And the love in the lives of the people around you. That's really what those worldly goals should be used for if you want to have any shot at true happiness.
Yeah.
My question is for you, Oprah. I'm wondering how, as you've gotten older, your approach to getting happier has changed.
I like that question, Eric, because as I've gotten older, and one of the reasons why I was so excited about working with Arthur here is because, Arthur, you confirmed my belief system. So I have known since I was a kid that life is better when you share it.
Yeah.
And I learned that with my first Three Musketeers bar, because growing up poor, I so seldom got candy. I would save it until like cousins came by, so because it tasted better when I could share it.
Yeah.
And now I know, Eric, that is one of the principles of enjoyment, which is what actually defines happiness.
Yeah.
Enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose.
Exactly right.
And so being able, so to answer your question, I would say that now that I know that the science actually backs me up on life is better when you share it, I want to share it more. So it used to be, I would just love doing a random act of kindness or doing something, you know, meaningful for somebody that would help them in their lives or enhance their lives. Now I make it a habit.
Yeah.
It's a part of my spiritual practice mm-hmm. to include the enjoyment for myself of making other people happier. So I would say, as I've gotten older, that's what I've actually learned about how to enjoy happiness, not just for myself, but how to spread it to other people.
Yeah.
All right, so let's explore this then through the lens of creating one's own perfect life.
Yes.
Which is pretty interesting, especially because, and interesting because I think this is so accurate to the way that most people are. It's not like, oh, there's some grand missing thing in my life, but you took that first action. So codify this for me or for anybody that wants, they don't know what their ideal life looks like. They just know that they're not living it yet. Mm-hmm. So step number one is take it seriously. To find out if the hypothesis is true or not, you have to take the experiment. You have to do it sincerely. Mm-hmm. What comes after that?
I think even one step before that is opening yourself up to new role models and new experiences. See, we live in echo chambers. We're just surrounded by the same thinking. How often do you bump into a monk? You know, it just doesn't happen. You don't have, no one has a dinner party and goes, oh yeah, we just invited the monk, you know, from town, like the local monk. Like no one ever does that. And so we meet people who are just like us most of the time. And we talk about this in business all the time. If you want to be a billionaire, spend time with billionaires. If you want to be a millionaire, spend time with millionaires. If you want to be a tech startup, spend time with, you know, that's the common rhetoric that we hear all the time. But what if you want to find purpose and master the mind? There's no one better than a monk who's mastered the mind. So for me, the first step is just opening yourself up to new experiences and new role models. Because most of us can't see ourselves in people, so then we try and fit ourselves into the boxes that we do see. And I mean, there's this beautiful quote that I've been saying it everywhere, and I wish I wrote it, but I didn't. So it's by a philosopher and writer named Cooley. And he said that today, I'm not what I think I am. I'm not what you think I am. I am what I think you think I am. Right? And just let that blow your mind for a moment. It's so powerful. I'm not what I think I am. I'm not what you think I am. I am what I think you think I am. So we live in this perception of a perception of ourselves. Hence, my identity is made by what my parents think I should be. My identity is made up by what my college or university thinks I should achieve. While you're living in that bubble and that echo chamber, getting to what you really want to do is impossible, because maybe that just doesn't fit. And I think so many people feel that way today, that they don't fit into the current education system. They don't fit with the 3 or 4 or 5 careers that you're taught exist. So that process of self-excavation and actualization first requires being exposed. You can't be what you can't see. If I never saw a monk, I would never have wanted to be a monk. If I never meet a billionaire, I wouldn't want to be one, because I wouldn't know what that feels like. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know what it takes. And I think that's the biggest challenge of our society, that we're not exposed. So that's the first step, being exposed to unique experiences and role models. Second step is finding that experience or role model that you're passionate about. And exactly like you said, taking it seriously. Shadow them, network with them, spend time with them, observe them, even from afar. It takes that observation, being addicted to observing that person's lifestyle. And then the third step is going, yes or no? Does that work for me? Not everyone who's gonna go off and become a monk is gonna feel like the way I did, and that's cool. But not everyone is gonna go and follow and shadow a billionaire and go, that's exactly the lifestyle I want. They may want the result, but do they want the hard work that goes with it? And so for me, that's the third step. It's observing, focusing, shadowing, getting as close to the process of that individual, and then going yes or no. Do I want that process? Not do I want the result? Everyone wants to be that monk who's fully enlightened, you know, can walk through, has an incredible aura that people just gravitate towards. But when you realize he has to wake up at 2 a.m. every day and sleeps about 4 to 6 hours, you're like, ah, you know, I don't want to do that. That doesn't sound like me.
Yeah. All right.
So I studied behavioral science at university, so I've always been fascinated by why people do what they do. And whenever I was reading these books that are 5,000 years old, my greatest fascination was finding a principle and finding its relevance in modern science. And I said to myself, the day I can't find that, I'll quit. I won't believe in this anymore. So I'm still doing that, and I'm ready to quit. If someone shows me a piece of science and I can't find a principle in these ancient literatures, or actually what I like to call these timeless literatures, then I'll give up my faith, because for me, it has to track forward. And I'll give you a really basic example. Today we're in the gratitude movement. There's like a million gratitude journals out there. There's a million scientific studies on gratitude, and gratitude has been linked to better mental health, self-awareness, better relationships. I mean, there's so many scientific studies on the neuro level that shows that gratitude is great for your mind, brain, and fulfillment. Now, I look back, like, gratitude is all over the timeless wisdom. One of the first things we were trained to do when we were a monk was to pay our respects to the earth for what it gives us. And you do that first thing in the morning. What is that if not gratitude? When you wake up in the morning, you thank the earth for the food, you thank the earth for the water, you thank the earth for allowing yourself to walk. You start your day with gratitude. Today, the biggest tip on Forbes and Inc. and everything is start your day with gratitude. Like, where does it come from? It's right there. These things are old. So I get fascinated. I'm intrigued by the parallels and patterns because it saves you time. It's the same way as which if I say that this business person got invested by this company and that's why they're successful because they had the right investors, etc. That's a pattern. So I know if I'm building a business in that area, I'm going to look for investors like that. It's the same thing. That pattern saves you time rather than you trying to figure out, does gratitude work? How shall I be grateful? Creating your own process almost.
I had one mentor that my brother introduced me to. His name was Alan Brown. He was a very successful philanthropist, entrepreneur, and he agreed to meet with me for lunch one day. And this one man in 1 minute, in one meeting, changed my life. Because he asked me, what goals do you have? And I said, what do you mean, what goals do I have? I said, I want to go out this weekend to the bar. I want to have some good food. I want to find a nice young lady to maybe hook up with. And he says, no, but what are your bigger goals? And I didn't have any. So he actually sent me home. And he said, fill out these pieces of paper. And on the piece of paper, it said, like, what age do you want to retire by? Like, I was 19. This was May of 1980. I wasn't even started yet. I said, but just fill out these papers. So I said, I want to retire by the time I'm 45 with $3 million. I want to have a Mercedes. I want to have a house. I want to travel the world. I want to have a great lifestyle. And so I came back on Monday and he looked at it and he asked me one question. And that question transformed my life. And he said, are you interested in achieving these goals or are you committed? And I stopped and I looked at him. He was standing up. I was sitting at my desk there at his office. And I asked him, Mr. Brown, I said, what's the difference? And he said, if you're interested, you'll do what's convenient. You'll come up with stories and excuses and reasons why you can't. And you'll use your education as an excuse. You'll use your story as an excuse. You'll use the fact your father was a cab driver and was a gambler and never had any money. You'll use all of that as your reasons why you can't. He says, but if you're committed, you will do whatever it takes. You'll let go of your stories. You'll let go of your excuses. You'll let go of all the reasons you currently have that are formulating your identity of yourself. And you'll learn how to let that go and become who you are destined to become. When I came back that following couple of days with my goals, and he asked me committed or interested, I said, I'm committed, shook my hand. He then put me through real estate school for 5 weeks. I graduated from real estate school May 20th, 1980. And the only reason those dates are ingrained in my brain, I passed the real estate test on my own without cheating. So that was step one. When I came back to the office, he had the forms that I'd filled out. He says, great, sit down. He says, I want you to read every one of them every morning that you come in the office at 7:30, and I want you to run your fingers across them.
Were these the goals or the beliefs?
Those are the goals, the goals that I had. So he had me write my vision for health, wealth, relationships, career, business, finances, charity, fun, experiences, everything, every area of my life. He had these documents. He said, I want you to read them every day. And you're going to do it while you come into the office so that I know that you've done them. And I want you to run your fingers across them as you're reading them. And then when you're finished one paragraph, close your eyes and I want you to feel, what would it be like if that was true? So he got me to see it, to touch it, to close my eyes and visualize it and to feel it. So at the time he didn't understand what he was really doing, but he was causing me to create new neural patterns in my brain that did not exist before. The only success that I'd ever really seen was on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And I said, one day, I want a life like that. And so every single day for a year, I had to do that. And it only took 10 or 15 minutes. And there was also beliefs. You talked about what else was in there. He also asked me to write down, what would you have to believe about yourself in order to achieve those goals? I said, well, I'd have to believe I'm smart enough, but I don't. He goes, I don't want to know what you don't. He says, what would you have to believe? Well, I have to believe I'm smart enough. I'd have to believe I'm deserving enough. I'd have to believe I'm worthy enough. I'd have to believe I'm capable of doing this. I'd have to believe these things. I wrote out a bunch of things, and he added a few more. He says, great. Now I want you to record those things. And on your way to work and on your drive to look at real estate homes, because 19 getting into real estate, you listen to those over and over and over and over and over again until you can recite every single one of them. So he taught me the power of repetition. He taught me the power of looking at stuff, touching stuff, feeling stuff, seeing stuff, hearing stuff, memorizing stuff. And at the time I was 19, I said, I mean, I felt this was fucking ludicrous to me, right? This is like, what the hell am I doing here? It was it was nuts. But that first year at 19, I made like 30 some odd thousand dollars, which was $5,000 more than my dad made as a cab driver. So I said, something's working. And I just kept doing it. I was too afraid not to. So I kept doing it. In the second year, I made $151,000.
Whoa.
Five times. Now, in the second year, he started upgrading my knowledge and skills more. So he started to say, okay, instead of doing this now you've graduated to doing this. And he taught me some upgraded skills. And so the combination of training my brain at a young age with beliefs that I wanted to have, he taught me the right habits to have, daily rituals, you know, for goal achievement versus goal setting.
That's interesting.
Right? So he said, everybody sets goals. Either they write them down or they don't. They have them in their head. I'm going to teach you how to achieve goals.
And you said, this is so cool. You were talking about how you wrote down these beliefs and you were reading them over and you were doing what you're told and you're running your finger across it. You're really allowing yourself to feel it, imagine it. And your brain was screaming something at you.
My brain was screaming, that's bullshit. That's not true. You're not successful. You're not earning that amount of money. You're not smart. You're not this. But I was also taught at the same time that when that happens, first and foremost, that's normal. That's the old self and the old patterns trying to fight for their life. And he said, with repetition and emotion and consistency, initially it's hard. And you have to use conscious effort to create the new beliefs. He says, but over 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 180 days, that new pattern that you're focusing on and paying attention to, your brain basically says, well, I guess you really don't need those old patterns. You keep activating these new ones. Let's just make these ones work and let's make these real. But I wanted to understand what happened. And with even the law of attraction, you know, I was taught the law of attraction, you know, I was 23, 24 years old. Also at a real estate conference, they're talking about this law of attraction thing, that there's this energy, everything's made up of energy. I am energy, you are energy. And my thoughts, you know, create this resonance between what I attract and what I don't. I'm like, oh good, I like that shit. You know, like I want to attract more of the good stuff, right? And so I bought in, like I bought into stuff that just made sense to me, but then I was a voracious student. I wanted to understand how. Like, explain to me how it works. Like, if somebody tells me visualize, I go, why? Like, how does it work? Like, if you ask me to visualize, like, why does it work? Like, why should I invest my time on that versus something else? If you're asking me to use affirmations, like, how specifically, why, how does it work? If you're asking me to emotionalize, well, what's happening in me that tell me I need to create these false senses of feelings? I want to know why it works.
And why does it work, especially emotionalizing? I think that's something that people hear a lot. I talk a lot about embodying something, really feeling it.
Yeah.
But why does it work?
Great, great question. It has to do with circuits in the brain and neurochemicals that are released. And so when we feel something, chances are that we're going to release dopamine in the brain, the feel-good neurochemical that activates the reward center of the brain. And chances are if we feel that and we have this positive emotion around it and that neurochemistry is flooding our brain and our body with feel-good chemicals, we're actually activating the motivational center of the brain. And so when we visualize, when we set a goal, when we take an action step, when we emotionalize, when we read our goals, the initial flood of neurochemicals, dopamine, serotonin, feel-good chemicals, and then if we share it with a friend, oxytocin, those three neurochemicals, those are the neurochemicals of goal achievement. But then there's the other side of it, the other circuits of fear, of stress, where norepinephrine, cortisol, or epinephrine, the stress hormones, can be released as well. And so I'm fascinated, and I want to teach people the stuff that we've learned about beliefs, self-esteem, self-worth, fears, and the stuff that really holds people back. Because all the how to get healthy and stay healthy, we know. How do I build a business and sustain it? We know. How do I get into a relationship and make it successful? We know. We know most of the how-to for anything that anybody wants to do in this time frame that we live in. So the how-to is the easiest part of the equation. So the harder part of the equation is, why am I not doing the things that I know I should be doing? And why am I not doing the things that I could find out easily how to do? I wanted to figure out if the stuff that I did in the 80s when I was a kid, you know, that broke free, would it work with some of my agents? And so we took 75 agents, randomly agents said, hey, do you want to get into a 6-month program to like retrain your brain, your subconscious brain, around your beliefs about what is possible for you to achieve, around your habits of what you have to do in order to achieve that. And we focused on retraining their subconscious mind. And so for 6 months, they had to go through a process of listening to certain audio tapes, reading certain materials every day, and following the process of training their brain, specifically their subconscious brain, which controls 95 to 98% of all of our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors today. And within 6 months, that group increased sales by $100 million.
Jesus.
$100 million. And I said, holy shit, right? This is working. And so we started to teach some of what we teach now in NeuroGym. Actually, now we have the technologies, we have the systems that are far better than what we did back in the 90s. And we went from 1.2 billion to 4.5 billion a year. And it wasn't because we taught them any more skills to be real estate agents. We taught them how to change the way they thought about themselves. We taught them how to change their habits.